Former Iowa Democratic Party Chair Tyler Olson has thrown his hat in the race for governor. Governor Branstad says he'll seek re-election. He's already cemented his ranking as the longest-serving governor in U.S. history. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today we'll set up the coming gubernatorial campaign from a distance of roughly 16 months before the 2014 general elections. We'll also talk about the most Democratic and most Republican counties in our state. These rankings may surprise you. Our analysts today, Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa. It's Politics Day. Join our conversation right after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday on our program today. Joining us to dissect the latest in politics, Dennis Goldford, professor of politics at Drake University in our Des Moines studio. Hello to you, Dennis.
Gentlemen, hello.
And Chris Larimer with us in Cedar Falls at our Cedar Falls studio, associate professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Ben.
Well, we have, it roughly breaks down into focusing on Iowa politics in the first half of our program, then pivoting over to the national scene in the second half of the program. In a few minutes, we want to look at the upcoming 2014 races, the Senate race here in Iowa, that open Senate seat to be vacated by Senator Tom Harkin. Also, the race for governor, we'll look at that. But before, I'd like to dig into some work that you've been doing, Chris Larimer, and start off also by asking our listeners, what are the most Republican, the most Democratic, and the most no-party counties, the most balanced parties, you could say, counties in Iowa. Counties is what I mean. So we have this picture of the national map of red states, blue states, purple states. What happens when we transfer that to Iowa and look at it on a county-to-county basis? And do you know how blue, how red, how purple your county is? Chris Larimer, what have you been doing to determine this?
Yeah, I guess this started a while ago, trying to figure out, as you said, what are the most Republican, what are the most Democratic counties in the state. And, you know, the Iowa Secretary of State's website provides a lot of useful information. It's freely available. And so what I did was collect party registration data for each county, so active voters who are registered as Republicans, Democrat, or no party, and pulled all the information from 2000 through 2012, broke it down by county, averaged those numbers by county, and then averaged those numbers over that period of 13 years to try to get a sense of the rank where you could rank the most Republican counties, the most Democratic counties, and the most no-party counties by party registration. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we were able to do that. And as it turns out, you know, there are some very predictable things. The most Republican counties, if we start with those, are as expected in western Iowa. They are in northwest Iowa and southwest Iowa. If we look at the rankings, we're talking about, you know, Sioux County, Lyon County, Osceola County, and O'Brien County. Those are the four counties in that northwest corner. And then you have Cass, Mills, and Montgomery County in southwest Iowa. And then in eastern Iowa, you have Franklin, Butler, and Grundy County. So these, at least in terms of party registration, are the most Republican counties over the last 13 years.
Okay. And when we look on the other side of the political spectrum, the most skewed in terms of registration toward the Democratic Party?
Yeah. And again, this is as expected. These are in the eastern part of the state. We're talking about Polk, Jasper, Monroe, Wapello, Davis, Lee, Des Moines, and then you have Johnson, Dubuque, and Jackson County in the far eastern parts of the state. So again, in terms of geographic dispersion, this breaks down as expected. You know, maybe what's interesting here is, you know, you can look at it in terms of party registration, but of course that doesn't necessarily tell how these counties vote or their vote share. But the GOP counties are strongly Republican counties, and then I think that's one thing that came through the data doing this over the last few weeks is that these counties are very Republican counties. They're very rural counties. If they have a strong GOP element, but they do not have much in terms of a Democratic element or a no-party element. So they're strongly Republican, but their vote share, if you look at in terms of how they cast their votes for president, they obviously go strongly toward the Republican ticket, but they make up a very small percentage of the total number of votes going to presidential candidates. Mm. The difference with the Democrats, yes, these are strong Democratic counties, but they don't differ as much from the other 89 counties as the top 10 Republican counties did. But their vote share is much higher. You're talking about usually 31% of the vote share for the Democratic candidate coming from these top 10 Democratic counties.
Okay. So what do you draw out that in terms of significance or surprises?
Well, I think the surprise is certainly one that we do still have a lot of Republican counties, and these are very Republican counties. When you start to do some correlations with this, I think what's interesting is counties that have a high Republican element tend not to have much of anything else. And that's that goes for both Democrats, which you'd expect. A county that's very Republican is not going to have very many Democrats. But a county that's very Republican is not going to have very many no-party voters either.
Okay. And for the Democratic-leaning counties, you're saying this is not the case.
Right. I mean, these Democratic-leaning counties are not as Democratic as the Republican ones. I mean, you're talking about the percentage of active voters in these counties that are registered as Democrat in the low to mid-40s. Where if you look at those Republican counties, you're talking about Republican registration in those counties usually well above 50%. If you get to Sioux and Lyon County, you're talking about counties that are close to 70% Republican. So, you know, we always talk about Iowa being kind of split between the three parties, whether, you know, with Democrat, Republican, and then no party usually making up the biggest bunch.
Right.
As you start to look at the data a little bit more closely, you see that these no-party counties tend to be more like Democratic counties, whereas Republican counties are simply Republican counties.
Talk a little bit more about that no-party county category. Those are purple counties. Where are those found?
Those generally are in the eastern part of the state as well. I mean, you have a couple of exceptions with Pocahontas and Calhoun County, but otherwise you're talking about Floyd, Bremer, Buchanan, Delaware, Benton, Iowa, Cedar, and Clinton. And those are really part of the eastern part of the state, and they tend to vote like the eastern part of the state. If you look at how these counties voted in the last two presidential elections, 8 out of the top 10 no-party counties had a majority vote share, that is more than 50%, going for President Obama. That's very similar to the top 10 Democratic counties. So again, these no-party counties tended to be located where you have strong Democratic counties, and they tend to vote like the top 10 Democratic counties.
Okay. Dennis Goldford, let me include you in on this interesting results for you also to contemplate here. Now, Iowa carries the national political weight that it does with our First in the Nation caucus. How might campaign strategists use this information to work more effectively?
Well, you don't go hunting where the ducks aren't, to quote Barry Goldwater from 50 years ago. You want to maximize turnout. You know, when it comes time to election, when you get within about a week or so of the election itself, conversion isn't that big of a factor anymore, trying to convince someone who's not for you to become for you. It's maximizing your turnout. You know, real estate people say the three most important factors are location, location, and location. In electoral politics, it's turnout, turnout, and turnout. Now, so you want to maximize your turnout, and you want to go hunting where the ducks are in terms of your particular party. In 2004, for example, the Republicans tipped Iowa to the Republican side compared to quite a number of previous elections, including 2000, because the Bush-Cheney campaign sent them and a lot of others out to northwest Iowa and I think increased turnout up in that area by about 12,000 votes. And that was enough to tip Iowa from the Republican, from the Democratic column in 2000 to the Republican column in 2004. But that being said, I wanted to mention that Chris's data are extremely interesting. But I think, of course, at a countywide level or a state legislative level, the degree to which these counties are skewed one way or another matters immensely. On a statewide level, not so much, I think, because, for example, Sioux County, as Chris rightly notes, is the most Republican county in the state. But as of July 1st, the total number of registered voters is about 20,000. The total number of registered voters in Polk County as of July 1st is about 13 times that number.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So one last little quickie. I recall after the elections of 1996 and 1998, when Tom Vilsack ran against Jim Ross Lightfoot for governor in 1998, and Lightfoot ran against Tom Harkin in 96. Lightfoot both times had a majority of the total vote in 93 counties. In other words, if you add up 93 counties with the six exceptions I'm about to make, Lightfoot won that vote. But the six biggest turnout counties, Polk and the rest are in eastern Iowa, Dubuque, Scott, Lynn, Johnson, and Blackhawk, in 96 Harkin and in 98 Vilsack, ran up such big majorities in those urbanized, more densely populated counties that they overcame the deficit they had against Lightfoot in the all 93 other counties.
So when we look at this map and we look at the traditional map of Iowa's 99 counties and color them red, purple, or blue, it perhaps makes more sense based on what you're saying, Dennis, is to give them not a geographic size but a size in terms of their population and sort of what would Iowa's map look like if you did that. And that would be more interesting to a political operative.
Sure. And Chris, perhaps you know how to do this with the right software. I don't know. But you know how sometimes you'll see in a political science, American government textbook or something like that, there'll be a map of the U.S. and the states are sized differently depending mm-hmm. upon the size of their electoral vote. And if we had a map like that for Iowa counties, I think that would be really indicative. I mean, consider, I've not counted since the last reapportionment, but when we had the old 5th District, you know, the districts, at least at the outset, have to have the same population as each other. And in districts 1 through 4 back then, at least 1 through 3, you needed 12 to 15 counties to get the right number. District 4, I think we needed 22 counties. But in District 5, Steve King's old district, the western third of the state, you needed 32 counties to get the same number of people you could get with 12 to 15 counties in eastern Iowa.
Yeah, I think Dennis is absolutely right. That's absolutely the next step, particularly for campaign operatives. And I think one thing you can do is start to look at, in addition to using the software that Dennis mentioned, is looking at candidate visits. So, there was a lot mentioned this last presidential cycle about why on earth would Mitt Romney, visit the eastern part of the state, go to Dubuque or Clinton County, I think he made visits, or why is Paul Ryan in Blackhawk County? Well, the answer obviously is vote share. I mean, they're going to get, 6,000-7,000 votes out of Sioux County or, 10,000-12,000 votes out of those northwest counties. But that's not going to matter much. They need to start pulling those no-party voters that are located
that's
in the eastern,
right.
more populated part of the state.
Mm-hmm. I would add to that that in the 2000 gubernatorial race, for example, again, Polk County is the gem, although it's mm-hmm. become less Democratic, more Republican or more independent over the years. But as soon as I saw on election night that former governor at that time, Branstad, was a couple hundred votes ahead of Governor Chet Culver in Polk County, I knew it was over because Culver had to run up big majorities in Polk County in order to overcome the deficit he was going to have in a lot of other counties around the state.
Interesting information that you dug up and crunched, Chris Larimer. And if you'd like to find out what color county you have, whether you're red county, a purple county, or a blue county, we're going to post that map along with link to Chris's information on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page, or go to iowapublicradio.org where you'll find River to River. Before we move on, anything else to say on that? There was a lot, and I'm sure we'll refer back to this work as we head toward 2014 and 2016, but for now, anything else?
No, I think that's it.
Okay.
I mean, that kind of covers it all.
Okay, good. Let's then take the remaining moments in this half hour to talk about the governor's race yesterday. State Representative and the former chair of the Iowa Democratic Party, Tyler Olson, announced his candidacy for governor. It was at his family's company, Paulson Electric, in Cedar Rapids.
You don't need me to tell you the world has changed in the last 30 years, and you certainly don't need me to tell you that the pace of that change is rapidly accelerating. Think about this. There were 300 million mobile app downloads in 2009 and 5 billion just 1 year later. And the amount of digital information available worldwide is expected to increase 44 times in the next few years. Despite what appears to be a decent economy, I think there are some long-term warning signs that Iowa is struggling to keep up in a rapidly changing world. Only 14 states have experienced slower job growth over the last 2 years, and Iowa remains at the very bottom for women-owned businesses and has the second slowest growth rate. Iowa is one of only two states that has seen more than 20% of its high-tech jobs disappear over the last few years. We're 35th for new business incubation and 49th in high-speed internet per capita. There are certainly some success stories worth acknowledging and celebrating, but living at the end of the last 30 years with the same leadership we had in the early 1980s is just not going to get the job done. I think Iowans are ready. I think Iowans are ready to leave that in the past and begin the next 30 years, which is why I'm here today to announce that I'm running for governor of this great state.
State Representative, former chair of the Iowa Democratic Party, Tyler Olson, yesterday announcing his candidacy for governor at his family's company, Paulson Electric, in Cedar Rapids. Well, gentlemen, you heard them. References to the past 30 years, 30 years during which much of the time Governor Terry Branstad was in office. Dennis Goldford, tell us, so what is going to be the strategy based on that 90 seconds we heard?
Well, I would imagine that, like potential candidate Jack Hatch, not more than one in five Iowans has ever heard of Tyler Olson or possibly Jack Hatch, and the Republicans have the same problem on the senatorial side. He's got to become well-known. He's got to attract funding. The same again for Jack Hatch. I mean, the Branstad campaign, well, supposed campaign, you know, it's always the coy, show a little bit of ankle, but not too much until you're ready. You know, when they say they've got $2 million in the bank, part of that is to warn off potential challengers. So they've got a lot of money. They've got to become known. And, you know, the American people and Iowans additionally aren't really ideologically conservative the way Republicans often think they are. They're fairly moderate, center left, center right, but they're temperamentally conservative. And what I mean by that is that good old country phrase, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And that's what benefits an incumbent. So Mr. Olson, like any other challenger against Governor Branstad, has got to convince the public, and he needs money and name recognition for this, that something is seriously broke, as it were, here in the state of Iowa under Terry Branstad.
Mm-hmm. So why has Governor Branstad, he's the longest serving governor in U.S. history. Is it something about Governor Branstad or something about our state that we have ascended to such heights with our governor?
Well, I came here to Iowa from Pennsylvania during Governor Branstad's first term. And I watched through the national press, such as it was at that time, the Conlon-Branstad race in 82. And essentially, at least according to the national press, that was hers to win until that tax issue came and undermined her candidacy. So that was probably his toughest race ever for statewide office, lieutenant governor or governor itself. I mean, he's won going away, not as much as Senator Grassley has his races, but he's won comfortably ever since. He visits all 99 counties. And to a great extent, although Governor Branstad certainly is socially conservative, he's not a culture warrior like Bob Vanderplatz, for example, and the family leader in their organization, which is why they didn't trust him so much and they ran against him in the primary in 2010. Governor Branstad back then would talk about same-sex marriage and he'd talk about abortion, but he didn't really want to. He wanted to talk about the budget, taxing, spending, business and economic development. And when I first came here in 1985, I heard people say that Governor Branstad should be called Minister for Trade rather than governor. And we see that he continues to do that with these various announcements. And so he's concerned with putting the state on a good business and economic foundation, and that's attractive to a wide variety of no-party voters as well as Republican voters.
Chris Larimer, your view on what has given Branstad his historic political longevity?
Well, I think you know, part of it is it fits with the history, the recent history in Iowa. You know, remember when Chet Culver was defeated in 2010, he was only the second incumbent to lose since 1962, back when Governor Irby lost to Governor Hughes. And so you had Governor Hughes for three terms. You had Robert Ray for 14 years. You had Governor Fulton in there for, I think, 15 days to finish out Governor Hughes's term. But then you had, following Ray, you had Branstad. And so, and then Vilsack for 8 years. And if Vilsack had run again, I think most people would tell you he would have served a third term. He would have been reelected. So I think generally Iowans seem to be satisfied with their governors, with the caveat that for you think of Ray, you think of Vilsack, and most of Branstad's terms, they've had a legislature of the opposite party. So I think as long as Iowans have that divided government and as long as the governor's doing what he should be doing, you don't have, you know, like in 2010 where you had a big movement from the Tea Party, you had an economic crisis, you had social issue come up with the Varnum v. Bryan ruling. As, you know, as long as you're kind of cruising along, you have divided government. Iowans tend to reelect their governor.
Okay, so we'll keep an eye on that. You mentioned longtime state senator Jack Hatch of Des Moines, also exploring the possible run for the Democratic nomination for governor. It's Bob Krause, another Democratic candidate. Lawmakers, former lawmakers, keep an eye on that race. Let's turn quickly before this segment ends to talk about the open Senate seat being vacated by Tom Harkin. The Democrats have had Congressman Bruce Braley, who's declared his intentions. He declared them earlier this year, has raised big capital for his war chest. The GOP has former U.S. Attorney Matt Whitaker and also Senator Grassley's former Senate Chief of Staff David Young. How is this race shaping up in your eyes, Dennis Goldford?
Well, there's also a business professor, I think, at Morningside. He left his talk radio program as well. I can't think of his
Clovis.
Name at the moment.
Clovis.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he could make things interesting just because of his background in radio. I was talking to somebody at Yankee Doodle Pops last week, and he wasn't, I don't think, intending to insult any of these potential candidates, but he said, how strange will this be next year when there's no real Democratic candidate for governor, and there's no real Republican candidate for senator. The problem is that it's hard to go from the minor leagues to the all-star game. These are high-profile races, the U.S. senator race, the gubernatorial race, they're statewide. They're very high-profile races. You need that name recognition to get voters to think of you, to get donors to consider giving to you. And when your profile's been very low in the state house or the state senate or someplace like that, it's hard to make that jump. These are people clearly who are wanting to try to do that.
Mm-hmm. So it's also interesting that Senator Grassley has been fundraising for both Whitaker and Young. He feels he needs to do that, or is that not unusual?
Well, I guess he doesn't want to take sides. You know, the last thing you want is a really divisive primary where the losing side will simply sit on their hands on election days because you're trying to defeat people whose votes you're going to need 5 months after the primary. Mm-hmm. So I think that's sort of covering all his bets and trying to be, I think, the elder inclusive statesman.
Mm-hmm. Based on what Dennis said, Chris, do you think that barring some big trip up by Congressman Bruce Braley, this should work out for the Democrats? I mean, it's hard to say that so many months in advance.
It is hard to say it so many months in advance, and it was a bit surprising how early Braley announced. But, I mean, you have to hand it to him. He announced he's not had a lot of challenge from the Democratic Party. It looks like he's going to not even have a primary. He's raised a lot of money. So I think at this point, you know, despite what the national media was saying about this being a very competitive race, right now it looks like it's Braley's to lose.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Chris, you mentioned as long as we're cruising along, as we end this segment, I want to say, speaking of cruising along, I'm sure you both heard of the governor clocking 84 miles an hour, was it?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I don't think we'll comment maybe on that when we come back, or have you think about what you'd like to say about that when we come back, also focusing on some national politics when we return. We'll talk about immigration reform chances, lack of chance for that to happen in Washington. Also, the Affordable Care Act, some developments there. Student loans, we heard that in the top of the hour news. We'll find out what's holding up that or causing them to remain double the interest rate. And we'd like to have you join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. We'll come back with Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa, Dennis Goldford, professor of politics at Drake University, dissecting our politics this week on Politics Wednesday. We'll be back in just a minute with more River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Great to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and we're surveying the political landscape as of late with Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa, also Dennis Goldford of Drake University. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Gentlemen, before we move on to some interesting national political developments, let's recall what we just mentioned at the end of the hour with cruising along, the reference to the governor. In late April, a state trooper clocked the vehicle carrying Governor Branstad and the lieutenant governor at 84 miles an hour on Highway 20. The SUV was being driven by another state trooper in an area where the speed limit is 65. The governor has said that 84 miles an hour is too fast, and the incident has launched investigations. So what do you think here? Does this story have any legs or wheels?
Oh, Ben, we'll have to talk to you about that one.
Okay.
You know, this it's very possible to be so engrossed in your work that you're in somewhere in a vehicle that you really aren't paying attention to the road. I mean, look how much people are warned about texting and being on the cell phone and so forth and letting speed and so everything get away from you. I think that the central issue, of course, is what this driver was doing. Now, we don't know whether the governor or lieutenant governor or both said we've got to get to point A, whatever they were going, and they really haven't been clear about that. Absolutely as fast as possible. You know, we don't know what kind of instruction he gave to them. There's still a lot of unknowns in this regard. And whatever difficulties the person, the trooper who filed the complaint, may have in his own career and personnel issues, that's independent of the fact that, yes, this vehicle with questionable plates was clocked at 84 miles per hour. So the question, I think, really is the extent to which people begin to think, if they do, that in some sense the governor and lieutenant governor think that they really don't have to obey the laws that everybody else has to obey.
And you know what? This triggered in my mind a very distant political memory that involves former Senator Roger Jepson of Iowa. I don't know if you know the reference I'm making here, but it was – I just looked up an article about it from dating in April 1983. Then Iowa Senator Roger Jepson, who lived then in Virginia, trying to avoid a $35 fine when he invoked immunity provided by the Constitution and told a police officer he could not be arrested for driving alone in the restricted highway carpool lanes because he was en route to Capitol Hill. At that time, that didn't go well over here in Iowa. But interesting to make that parallel, and interesting your remarks, Dennis Goldford. Let's move on to some interesting political news on a national basis. Immigration reform. It seems too early to say this, but as we set the stage for 2016, that presidential contest, some issues are emerging as fault lines, especially for the GOP. Immigration reform and the recent Supreme Court ruling on the Defense of Marriage Act. Potential hopefuls are taking some very different positions on these issues. At a Faith and Freedom Coalition conference in Washington, D.C. a few weeks ago, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush talked about how U.S. birth rates are declining while a large segment of the population is reaching retirement age and qualifying for Social Security and Medicare. He went on to explain why the situation could be helped by approving immigration reform.
Immigrants create far more businesses than native-born Americans over the last 20 years. Immigrants are more fertile, and they love families, and they have more intact families, and they bring a younger population. The one way that we can rebuild the demographic pyramid is to fix a broken immigration system to allow for people to come, to learn English, to play by our rules, to embrace our values, and to pursue their dreams in our country with a vengeance to create more opportunities for all of us. This is a conservative idea. And if we do this, we will rebuild our country in a way that will allow us to grow. If we don't do it, we will be in decline.
Okay. Former Governor Jeb Bush there urging passage of the Senate immigration reform proposal championed by Senator Marco Rubio and others. But at that same committee markup meeting for the bill, Senator Ted Cruz explained why he wouldn't support it.
I want common sense immigration reform to pass. I think our immigration system is broken. I think there are large bipartisan majorities in this country that want common sense immigration reform to pass. And this bill, in my view, has two major problems. Number one, it doesn't fix the problem. It doesn't stop illegal immigration. If anything, it may make the problem worse by not securing the border and by incentivizing future illegal immigration, which means human tragedies would flow as a direct result if this bill were to become law. But number two, I believe in its current form, this bill is not likely to become law. It may well have the votes to pass the Senate, but I do not believe this bill will pass the House of Representatives or become law. And I would view that as a terrible outcome if Congress did not actually fix the problem.
Senator Ted Cruz of Texas. So, Chris Larimer, is there any agreement in the GOP about immigration reform?
It seems to be slowly fading away. I mean, I think, you know, when you think about Jeb Bush and you think about Senator Ted Cruz, these are two very different Republicans. And Senator Cruz is already being talked about as a potential candidate in 2016. So I think, you know, you have to consider what he's trying to where he's trying to position himself for a potential maybe Republican primary in 2016 by taking that hard line against immigration reform. And the second part of all this is that the Gang of Six or Gang of Eight that came out after the 2012 election led by Senator Marco Rubio was in large response to the results of the 2012 election with Barack Obama winning close to, I think, 73% of the Hispanic vote. So there was a push for it then, but as, you know, the details of the bill start to come out, you start to see Republicans sort of fading back to their traditional position on this, where it's first about security and then about, immigration reform.
In some private conversations that Politico had with some top Republicans on Capitol Hill, they now predict comprehensive immigration reform will die a slow, months-long death in the House. Is that what you see going on as well, Dennis Goldford?
At this point, I think. We have to remember, and the political folks and others have noted the point that I've at times tried to make before on the program here, that we don't have truly national elections in which the whole country votes as a single constituency, a single electoral unit. The closest we have is the presidential race, but the president runs not nationally. The president runs in 51 separate elections, the 50 states and Washington, D.C. But for members of Congress, the Senate and the House, they have different electoral constituencies from each other and from the president. And interestingly, if Cruz does want to get a presidential nomination, opposing this might help him get a nomination but could hurt him nationwide, because nationwide is where that particular Hispanic vote comes into play with regard to certain key states. But your average member of the House on the Republican side, as Politico noted today, represents a constituency that has next to no Hispanic voters. And so as cold as it says, you know, when Tom Latham runs for the third district seat, he doesn't have to care what's happening in Steve King's fourth district seat, because they're two different districts. And, you know, there's that other old phrase, you dance with the one who brung you. Mm-hmm. And the Republicans, with very few exceptions in the House, represent districts that tend to be not totally white and Anglo, if you will, but predominantly white and Anglo, and older and more conservative and more Republican. And for their electoral prospects, they don't have to care about any blowback on this immigration issue, whereas a senator is more likely to have to care, and a president really has to care, a presidential candidate.
Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa with us as we head toward the end of this Politics Wednesday here on River to River. Another issue that's likely to create some division among the GOP field is the U.S. Supreme Court ruling overturning the Defense of Marriage Act and extending federal benefits to legally married gay couples. Here's what Senator Rand Paul had to say after the ruling on Fox News.
I don't think we're going on towards polygamy or things beyond that, but I do think that our country is divided on the issue, and that in some ways the Supreme Court decision is probably going to allow us to agree to disagree. Some states like New York may go forward with gay marriage and have. Some states in the South probably won't, and not even in the foreseeable future. So I think we can agree to disagree, and that's kind of what our founding fathers talked about when they talked about federalism, that each state would sort of be an incubator of its own ideas and would be given the freedom to have disparate laws to a certain degree.
Mm-hmm. Senator Rand Paul there, we can't agree to disagree. This is the founding fathers' intent. Contrast that with the statements from Senator Marco Rubio, also New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who were critical of the ruling overturning the Defense of Marriage Act. Chris Larimer, Where is the GOP going on this issue of same-sex marriage?
Well, I think it's a difficult issue for them. You know, when it comes time to voting, there are single-issue voters, and there are the voters who are going to vote on a single social issue. But the trend, and I haven't seen the latest numbers nationally, but certainly in Iowa, following the Varnum v. Bryan ruling, there was a lot of backlash, a lot of voters who expressed disgust with the ruling. But then, you know, you got 6 months later, you get 18 months later after that ruling, and Iowans now have slowly creeped over to the majority saying that that ruling was the right decision. And so if that's a trend that's happening nationally, that presents a real problem for the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm. And also to point out, Republican contenders facing, won't they, Dennis, face increasing pressure to show more tolerance towards same-sex marriage, given that there is this generational split on this issue? Republican voters in their 20s, 30s, maybe even 40s, more likely to be accepting of this.
Well, it depends upon what state you're talking about, number one. I mean, Chris, I agree with what you said about there hasn't been the volcanic reaction or at least results in Iowa. Yet still, I think one of the major battles in Iowa in 2014 will be the Republicans' attempt to gain control of the Senate. And you will definitely see an attempt to pass to begin the process of amending the Iowa Constitution to overturn the Varnum decision. So that has not gone away and settled down in the state of Iowa, certainly among Republicans. But the difficulty for supporters of equal rights to marriage for gays and lesbians is that your younger people may well be more tolerant, Ben, but is that issue going to motivate them to turn out? Whereas the people who oppose it are going to be older. Older voters tend to turn out more intensely and frequently than younger voters on average anyway. And in Iowa, for example, this particular issue will motivate a bigger turnout among, again, older, wider, more conservative, more Republican voters, most of whom, at least in the state, tend to oppose this particular practice.
Mm-hmm. Chris, can you imagine in the future a political climate in which support for these rulings could become acceptable in the majority of Republican primary voters here in the state of Iowa or nationwide?
Well, I think, you know, I think it is a generational thing, as you mentioned. I think Dennis is right that, you know, there are certainly, for some voters, this is still a big issue. But I think it all depends on turnout, like Dennis said. If this is an issue where you see more people voting, it's not just an older generation voting. If you see the 18 to 24-year-olds, you see turnout going up among that population, and it's going and they're voting in the predictable way in the sense that these rulings are acceptable, then yes, this is going to be something that the Republican Party is going to have to deal with. But if it's a salient issue, but the people who are in favor of it are not voting, then they really don't have to worry about it.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of the younger generation, we heard in the top of the hour news, Senate Democrats tried to hammer out a deal today on the student loan interest rate measure on July 1st. The rates for subsidized student loans doubled to 6.8%. I guess the news was that this one-year extension did not pass a procedural hurdle. Any background from either of you on what the fix will be for these federal loans to get them back to 3.4%? What's holding it up?
Well, I'm not sure about the background necessarily on it, but I think the New York Times reported earlier this week that I think Congress has passed a total of, and Dennis might know this, I think 15 bills, and this is historic low for Congress. And so I think the idea of not getting something done on this, unfortunately, seems to fit the trend of the saying of a do-nothing Congress, where mm-hmm. you have Republicans saying, we don't want a short-term fix, we want a long-term fix, right. Democrats saying the exact opposite.
Do students with debts or former students with debts have any real political clout?
If they have, if they're great, if they have high numbers, yes.
You agree, Dennis?
Well, I'm old enough in terms of when I was in college, I've been waiting 40 years for the youth vote to show up. And it showed up a little bit in the last election, although partly it was young voters and partly it was minority voters that helped reelect the president. But the difficulty for the youth vote is that it's not permanent. I mean, we're all youthful for a while and then we're no longer youthful. So we're not a permanent member of that particular group and focused on issues that over time will dissipate as far as we're concerned. So again, as Chris said, it's just a matter of who turns out. Politicians respond very quickly to very strong voting turnout signals from the electorate. And so when policies are occurring that you don't particularly like, you got to go back and ask, have you turned your people out?
before the hour ends, I want to talk about the Affordable Care Act. Yesterday, House Republicans, the leaders, seized on the Obama administration's one-year delay of a mandate. We heard about this last week, for larger employers to offer health insurance or face penalties. They put in a delay that government, the GOP leadership, rather, demanding the same postponement for the mandate on individual insurance purchases. What is the GOP strategy here, Dennis?
By all means possible, kill that bill or kill that law. I mean, that's their overriding concern. You find the interesting circumstance in which many Republicans who are absolutely opposed to the Affordable Care Act arguing the president has to put the employer mandate into force now. He doesn't have the discretion not to enforce a law that's passed Congress. That's a constitutional argument. They hate this bill, and yet they want him to enforce it because, in their view, that will show how it's, in their view, unworkable and lead to all sorts of problems for the Democrats among the voters.
Mm-hmm. Can the GOP delay this until it's too late?
Delay the bill, you mean?
Well, delay the implementation.
Well, you know, to the extent that the implementation of the bill requires Congress to pass some funding, it's very possible for the Republicans to block that the way they've blocked other things in Congress through control of, well, Congress and the filibuster threat in the Senate. So the pieces of it that are administrative, they can't really block, but anything that requires additional legislation, they can.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk quickly about the farm bill's future, remaining in serious doubt in the House this week, that after a reluctant Agriculture Committee Chairman Frank Lucas said he would support splitting the measure to allow separate votes on the nutrition title, a strategy promoted by Majority Leader Eric Cantor. I wonder, Chris Larimer, if you can explain what's going on with the farm bill and why this strategy of splitting the nutritional title food stamps away from, I guess, the subsidies for farmers, right?
Right. I think what's going on is there was just a lot of uproar and surprise, perhaps, that the farm bill was not renewed, and they ended up having to do a temporary extension of this until September 30th. The big sticking point between the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate is, as you said, the food stamp portion of it. The U.S. House wants to cut a significant portion of the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. The Senate does not want to cut as much. And, you know, you have the Senate controlled by Democrats, the U.S. House controlled by Republicans. And so that's where the bill is breaking down. And that's why the U.S. House was unable to pass it last week. You know, an attempt to split it, that may work, but you're not seeing a lot of Republicans uniting around this idea of splitting it. You know, we've heard the current Ag Secretary and former Iowa Governor Tom Vilsack talk a lot about rural America and rural America losing its clout in Congress. I think, you know, if when you see things like this, I think it resonates a bit with what he said. You know, I would be surprised if they don't renew it, but I'm surprised that it's taken this long to get where they are now.
Well, one count, 62 Republicans in the House voted against the farm bill.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's a big chunk. Mm-hmm.
How do you interpret this split strategy, the nutrition titles, a split away from the farm subsidies, Dennis?
Well, I don't know if we have time to go into the history of this. You know, these were paired together to gain the supplemental nutrition aspect of the farm bill was introduced to solve a problem of hunger in the big cities, but that also was a strategy to enlist urban support for a farm bill because obviously urban legislators don't represent farmers and they don't have any particular interest necessarily in the concerns of farmers. So if you tie an interest to urban legislators in supplemental nutrition, together with an interest in rural or legislators, members of Congress, some more rural districts that do have a lot of farmers, you find some way to cobble together majority support in this regard. The Democrats generally are in favor of this. The Republicans, again, some simply argue that you should not provide this kind of supplemental nutrition help, which in fact aids farmers because you increase the market for farmers to sell their products. It's just that the government pays for it instead of the private individual through food stamps or whatever they're called now. But you've also got other Tea Party kinds of Republicans who think the government shouldn't be in the business of providing farm subsidies anyway. And so there's that tie of interests there, or that collection of interests that complicate this immensely.
Dennis Goldford, thank you very much for your analysis this hour. Professor of Politics at Drake University, Chris Larimer, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa in our Cedar Falls studio. Chris, Dennis, thanks as always for all the insights this hour.
You're very welcome.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Technical support from Dennis Reese. And Cedar Falls, help from Tony Daner this hour in Des Moines. I believe help from John Pemble. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow on this program, it's going to be a news roundup. We'll talk about outbreaks of cyclospora. We'll also talk about some sports. Iowa's Zach Johnson competing as the defending champion at the John Deere Classic Golf Tournament. Those and other bits of news for our news roundup. But let's turn to Charity Nebbe, host of Talk of Iowa at 10 o'clock tomorrow, who's in the studio with me. Charity, what's in store for you?
Well, you probably already know that the Lincoln Highway is turning 100 this summer, and we're going to do a show about the Lincoln Highway. We're going to talk about the history of the highway. We're going to find out what it was like to actually drive on it. We'll talk to a man who has driven his Model T Ford over 88,000 miles around the United States. He's been to 49 states in his Model T, so we'll talk about that. And we'll also find out about the economic impact that the highway had on small towns and that the highway bypasses have had on small towns in Iowa as well.
We'll be reaching out to listeners who remember traveling the Lincoln Highway, perhaps as youngsters.
Right.
Join Charity Nebbe tomorrow on Talk of Iowa. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.